Welcome to the Fresh Heart Project. I'm Zareen, a consultant cardiologist and your host. I am delighted to share this conversation with you. But before we get into this episode, if you want to keep up to date with all things Fresh Heart, please subscribe to our podcast, available on all popular podcast platforms. You can also subscribe to our YouTube channel. Don't forget to hit the bell for notifications on all new videos. Now, on this episode, I sit down with Dr. Harriet Holm and we discuss how we can eat to create health. We cover so much ground, from food misinformation to taking supplements to the issues with restrictive eating. Harriet is a wealth of information. She is a registered nutritionist and a former experienced pediatrician. She is also an author, host of the Eating for Health podcast, and a lecturer in nutrition. Harriet is passionate about sharing science-backed, credible information to empower you to eat for your health. Oh, Harriet, I am delighted to welcome you onto this episode. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, no, it is my pleasure, because I've been following you on social media for quite some time, ever since a mutual friend introduced us. And I love what you share. You share amazing nutrition evidence and advice, but it's always science-backed, it's always very pragmatic, it's non-judgmental, and it's easy to access and follow. But you've not always been a nutrition specialist, have you? You were a pediatrician at one point, weren't you? What was your journey from pediatrics to nutrition specialist?
Yes, that's true. It's been a long journey. So I studied medicine back in 99 at the University of Cambridge. And then I was a pediatrician, ultimately a pediatric oncologist, up until fairly recently. And then I did my PhD in the genetics of actually a really rare type of bone cancer, so sort of cancer genetics in the laboratory. And it was during that time that I just sort of really became fascinated by the microbiota, so all of those millions and trillions of bugs that live in us and on our surface, and the genetics of that, the microbiome, and how we're really in our infancy with understanding what a huge impact that has on health, on how we respond to disease, on how we respond to drugs, and even chemotherapy. And then for a number of reasons, I decided I would leave the NHS and I became a registered nutritionist. I now lecture in nutrition. I was commissioned to write a degree combining those health and nutrition skills to make sort of a first type of degree in this country. And now I see my own private clients. And as you say, I've got video courses and podcasts and lots of information on my website and Instagram. So it's been an interesting journey. I think I've got a particularly different or unique skill set. But I think fundamentally, nutrition is such a science that having those parts, that experience does really, really help me. And I think it's really only been through certain parts of my career that have exposed me to gain those skills to help understand the science.
And it's so hard to convey that in an easily accessible way, and you do actually do that really brilliantly. So I encourage everyone who's listening to, you know, follow you on Instagram, follow you on social media, because I really trust everything you say. But I don't think it's always that easy. You mentioned that, you know, you have this really immense grounding in pediatrics, in science, in research, in knowing how to appraise evidence and information, and then you translate that into your nutrition advice. You're also a registered nutrition specialist. But when I look at social media, I see so many people who have nutritionist or nutrition specialist or lots of things against a name, and sometimes the information that is being put out isn't always as accurate, it isn't always as balanced. So how do people know that they are getting correct information? How do you avoid misinformation when someone has nutrition specialist by their name?
No, it's a great question. So I'm really surprised that the title nutritionist is not protected. So anybody with no qualifications and no experience could set themselves up as a nutritionist or a nutrition coach or a nutrition therapist with no professional body. It is quite incredible. And they can share whatever pearls of wisdom they like. And that's nutrition advice. So I think that is quite worrying, to be honest. And that's why that you'll hear really all sorts of different opinions, because there's no regulation on those opinions. To be a registered nutritionist, you for the most part, you have to have done a degree in nutrition or provide a very large and detailed portfolio of evidence and referees to demonstrate that you have the equivalent knowledge of a degree. And then those people that are registered nutritionists have a professional body and have standards and are regulated in a different, in a way that a dietitian is regulated, and that is a protected title. So I am a registered nutritionist, and I agree. I think that most people don't know that. They think that if you're a nutrition coach or a nutritionist, you've got the same skill set as a registered nutritionist. And that's why, you know, I'm shocked sometimes the things I hear. I know there's someone in Australia who says that bone broth is better for babies than breast milk, and all sorts of really quite frankly dangerous things. So I think it really needs to be tightened up so that people know and can trust the advice that trust and work out whose advice to follow. But essentially, nutrition advice should come from a registered nutritionist or a dietitian.
Yeah, yeah. So look out for the registered in front of the title, I guess.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, I think that's true for medics as well. I mean, I got no nutrition training in medical school. I got no nutrition training in my cardiology training either. How important do you think nutrition is, or a basic understanding of nutrition is, for medics and doctors? Or do you think more we should actually have a collaboration between nutritional specialists and medics? What do you think? How do you think it should work?
I think we actually probably need a bit of both. So I certainly think that people at medical school, so medical students, should have nutrition education, and that should continue during specialty training, especially for GPs. Because I think that each consultation is an opportunity to help someone with prevention. And if they don't have that skill set, that opportunity is lost. But equally, they are a doctor and not a registered nutritionist or dietitian. And so it really needs to be within that wider NDT, so that any more difficult problems or extended consultation could be done by someone who specialises in nutrition. So I know that certainly things are changing, and I think that's fantastic that medical students are getting that teaching now, which is brilliant, and is what they need. But certainly we know that nutrition and what's on your plate is one of the biggest modifiable risk factors for disease, and we should all be empowered to eat better and try to improve our long-term health.
Yeah, absolutely, especially with so much confusing information out there. And it's very hard, even when you think you're doing the right thing, to know, isn't it? Because when you go to the shops, there's loads of marketing buzzwords like clean and natural and real and superfood. And it's very clever, isn't it? But you don't always get good, healthy food, do you? And they're packed full of sugar and packed full of other things that aren't so good for us. Do you have any advice on how, when you're in a supermarket and you're in the clean food section or the good for you section, how you can avoid those buzzwords, so to speak?
Absolutely. So I think there are a huge number of marketing buzzwords, and I think the way to sort of avoid them is really to eat a whole food diet. The less processed food you can eat, the more just fruit and vegetables, whole grains, lean protein. There's quality fats like avocado, olive oil, nuts, seeds, and then omega-3, your oily fish like salmon and mackerel and herring and anchovies and sardines, and then your fermented food. If you can eat as much of that that's unprocessed, that can only be better for you. And I think that really the marketing words are generally for the more processed foods, although there are marketing jargon with teas, your detox teas and those kind of things. But generally just avoid or sort of pay no attention to these words like superfood and detox and cleanse and clean and natural, because they really are meaningless.
And they come with an added price tag, don't they, quite often?
They do. There's no doubt about that.
And when, you know, I've got a lot of patients who come to my clinic and they're very interested in what they should eat and how should they eat. And there are some underlying principles, aren't there, that are good by and large for every condition, for every disease, including the heart. What, in your opinion, would you say are these underlying principles?
So really to sort of kind of reiterate, I guess, what I've, you know, just sort of said again about the about looking around the supermarket. So try to eat as little processed food as possible. So it's fruit, vegetables. So if you think of your plate, sort of about half your plate, fruit and vegetables, about a quarter of whole grain carbohydrates, that's about a fistful, and then a quarter lean protein. It doesn't matter where you get your protein from, but try to avoid processed meat, as that has been linked with long-term increased risk of cancer. And then a spoon or two of those healthy oils like olive oil, avocado, and then fermented foods like kefir, kimchi, as sort of the raw sauerkraut type stuff. And those are really your, oh, and the oily fish, your omega-3s twice a week, once a week if you're pregnant. Those are really sort of the backbone things that you need to be doing. And the more, oh, and I could probably add in a handful of nuts a day. But those are the sort of common themes of what a healthy diet should look like. And I think there's probably an awful lot of overlay or confusion about, you know, if I've got this, I should have that. And there are, you know, specifics for different types of condition or how to you know, sort of tweaks to it. But really, those are the fundamental principles for pretty much for everybody. And it's how you incorporate that into your life. And I think it shouldn't be about taking things away. It should be adding more variety and adding more healthy food. So certainly been the sort of studies that show a dose response effect with like fruit and vegetables. So it's not about or limiting fruit because it's got sugar. It's about adding more fruit and vegetables into your diet, because they've got all those polyphenols and fiber that are really good for you.
I love that. Adding more fruit and vegetables, because invariably when you do that, you do feel a bit fuller, don't you? And so if you can do that and then tend to take away some of the stuff that's not so good for you, then that could be really, really beneficial. But even just having more fruit and veg can be beneficial, can't it?
Absolutely. And I think most of us generally know what a healthy diet sort of looks like. But a lot of the time it comes down to partly sort of building that into your habit and routine, and knowing what your sort of emotional triggers are, and understanding there's a difference between physical hunger, emotional hunger, and that if you're eating chocolate, it's probably not because you're actually physically hungry, it's because you want to pick me up, or you're feeling a bit low, or, you know, for other reasons. And so sort of teasing those apart can help, you know, sort of get on a track of eating better most of the time. But about, you know, we're all human, none of us are robots, none of us eat brilliantly, you know, well, 100% of the time, and knowing that that's okay, but knowing those sort of fundamental principles, and that you're going to make healthy choices as much as you can.
Absolutely. And you mentioned emotional eating there, and there's a difference between that, isn't there, and eating as a treat.
Yeah, so I generally try to avoid thinking of things as a treat, because I tend to think of there being no restricted foods. You can have whatever you want, whenever you want. But if you try to make those healthy choices each time you have a choice. But I'll sort of talk now a bit about sort of emotional and physical hunger. So the way you can sort of differentiate them, because I think it's only really when you sort of sit down and think about it, do you then think, oh, maybe that's me actually. Or maybe I do that sometimes. And the vast majority of us do this, that if you're physically hungry, the hunger sort of slowly builds up. And then you're sort of thinking about food, and anything would work. And, you know, you can wait a bit until you get there, and it's okay. And something, it doesn't matter what it is, that you'd eat it, you'd feel full, and you wouldn't have any negative emotions. Whereas emotional hunger normally comes on really pretty quickly, and you suddenly have a need for something really specific. So it has to be that chocolate bar. And only the chocolate bar will do. And then a lot of the time people eat the chocolate bar. It doesn't fill them up because they were never physically hungry. It hasn't filled an emotional void or an emotional need, the reason, the trigger why they wanted it. So maybe they were tired, or they were bored, or they were stressed, or they were feeling low. And, or maybe just habit. Sometimes, you know, after dinner equals, you know, chocolate or whatever, a dessert. And then you feel a bit guilty, you know, because you've eaten it, and then you think, I shouldn't have eaten that. And then that can often perpetuate the cycle then, that you feel bad about eating, and then to help yourself feel a bit better, you'll then have another biscuit or another chocolate bar or whatever. So I think it's about sort of being mindful of that, and then you're thinking about, am I hungry? What am I really hungry? And then making those healthy choices when you can. And if you're feeling, actually, I'm just emotionally hungry, then go off and try to do something else completely different. Go have a walk, go do yoga, go do a hobby, ring your friends, do something else completely. And probably the emotional hunger will have gone and been distracted.
Yeah, that's brilliant. And then that takes your focus off the food, doesn't it, when you get into that, when you have those emotions. And you've also written a beautiful article about how stress and nutrition interact. And so that also interacts with the gut microbiome. So firstly, can you tell us what the gut microbiome is? And then secondly, can you tell us how stress interacts with that?
Sure. So in your gut, you've got trillions of bacteria. There are more bacteria, protozoa, viruses, all these single cell microorganisms in your gut than there are stars in the sky. So I think it's, you know, it's absolutely incredible. And we really sort of live in like sort of symbiosis, where we really need the bacteria, the microorganisms, and the microorganisms really need us. And the more we learn about them, the greater we understand their role to be in our health and long-term risk of disease. And also, they've got a really important role in immunity. The greatest collection of our immune cells is in our gut. These bacteria help sort of present what's called the sort of antigens, a sort of like I guess the sort of flags or signals on different cells and parts of cells and bacteria fragments, so that our immune system learns to understand what's self and what's not self, and is sort of now linked to lots of autoimmune diseases. So we know they are really important. And if you do the genetic sequencing of them all, that's called your microbiome. This is a really an active area of research. We're understanding more and more about what our microbiome is, what a healthy one is, how you can modulate it, how it varies between region, how it changes, why it changes, and how we can modulate it. It's a very active area of research. So we do now know that it's what's called a gut-brain axis, where there's two-directional communication between the gut and the brain. And so what you eat affects your microbiota, but those microorganisms, but what your microbiota are doing also affects your brain and your mood. And there's certainly sort of some evidence now that different microbiotas are all sort of or different species and their ratios and things are linked with feelings of low mood. And it all sort of is really linked with stress hormones and cortisol, and how it all sort of plays it together is really quite complex, and I think really quite an interesting area of research, and how stress can cause us to, and the cortisol hormone can increase our desire for low nutrient, high sugar, high fat food. So a McDonald's or, you know, a fast food, junk food type thing. And if you think of sort of going back to sort of back to medicine, you think about cortisol and how, you know, that's really associated with it gaining weight. And the same thing happens if you're stressed, you've got chronic cortisol release, you're driven to eat those foods, and partly through the stress hormones, but partly through your microbiota, the more you eat those type of junk food, the more your microbiota possibly feeds back into that, and you're feeding the wrong type of microbiota. And it's really fascinating how the microbiota might be able to modulate that, might be able to improve stress, improve anxiety, improve mood. And it's all really, there's lots of interplay and lots, I think, to unravel still.
Absolutely. It's such a fascinating area of research, isn't it? I find it amazing and incredible that what you eat can affect how you feel and your mood. And I certainly see it. When I'm eating, when I've had a weekend where I've had, you know, junk food or takeaway or something that, you know, not necessarily healthy, I feel low and I can feel it the next day. I definitely don't, my mood does respond to what I'm eating. And conversely, if I'm eating healthily, I do feel better. So I can firsthand say that it does affect mood. And I think it's, you know, you do see a lot of things out there about how you can nurture your gut microbiome. Are there any, you know, surefire evidence-based ways in which you can promote healthy, you know, microbiome?
Yeah, so healthy gut microbiota are, first of all, have lots of fruit and vegetables because they feed off their insoluble fibre of both fruit, vegetables and whole grains. So whole grains, fruit and vegetables, lots of variety, really eat the rainbow. And then fermented food, so helping put bacteria back in. That's things like kefir, the kombucha, a low sugar kombucha, and then sauerkraut and kimchi, those kind of things. And then avoid trans fats and avoid sweeteners because they're thought to have deleterious effects on the microbiota.
So what role do probiotics play?
Well, I'm quite cautious of probiotics. I think we need a lot more information about probiotics. And I think that's really because we don't fully understand them. And so I actually get quite concerned when I see all these influencers promoting them because the reason why I feel cautious about them is because what we know in the gut is that diversity is probably a really good thing. So you want a really diverse, lots of different types of species, lots of different organisms, but we don't fully know what healthy one looks like for an individual. What we don't know is how that links with probiotics. So probiotics are mainly bacteria that are given, you take them by mouth, and we know that they colonize the gut. So they then set up shop and they start living there, and you can find them in the stool. So that's what a probiotic is. But probiotics probably stop as soon as you take them. They only are there living in the gut for as long as you take them. And then there are lots of different types of probiotics. Some have got lots of different species and some have got one or two species or just a single species. And when the research has been done for them, they've been done with just a very specific species or group of species. And it's been done for a very specific indication. So to look at, for example, bloating, and that would be your end point. And then the trial would look, it would randomize people either to take the probiotic or not have the probiotic, to have a placebo. And then they would see if the bloating improved or not. And if it was found to be significant, then they would say this, you know, probiotic decreases bloating. But because probiotics are actually a supplement and not a medication, it means that the legislation, the restrictions around them are much less than for a medication. And so they are sold not for that specific one indication, but they are sold as sort of a health promoting food, you know, health promoting supplement and something to help your gut. But what all that we know, for example, is that in that one example, it helped reduce bloating. It didn't do anything else. And so unless you look at the research, work out what your specific symptom indication is, you know, do I have bloating or do I have this? And then you choose the right strain of probiotic. You don't know whether you've got the right strain to do the right thing. And we also don't know what the individual role of your microbiota and how that relates back, because we just don't have the research. Not enough research has been done. And we don't know whether having a probiotic species with lots of different probiotics species in it is better than a single one, or does a single one better, but do they compete? Are you increasing diversity or are they just competing? We don't know. And also that I think the thing that gives me the most concern is that your gut microbiota is significantly impacted after you take antibiotics. And that's to be expected because your antibiotics are going to kill off a lot of your microbiota. But antibiotics are given for a reason that's important. So you should take the antibiotics if you've got, you know, an infection that you're being treated. You should follow your doctor's advice. But the downside to them, the side effect, is that they do impact the microbiota. And some of them actually for up to 2 years. So how do you replace those lost, that lost microbiota, that lost diversity. And so I think, you know, probiotics had been, you know, thought of as maybe we could use those probiotics to replace those lost microorganisms. There's actually been some new research in Cell, like a high impact journal. A couple of studies have shown that, well, first of all, in about half the population, they did absolutely nothing. So they're just money down the drain. And for the others, there's a significant risk that they might actually have a sort of placeholder effect where they are blocking reconstitution of the microbiota. So they go in, those probiotics that you're taking, those strain of bacteria, set up shop and start living in your gut while you're taking them, but prevent all of your other diversity, prevent full reconstitution of your gut microbiota. And so they might actually be doing more harm than good. And so I think it sort of comes back around to the idea that these are not medicines. We don't fully know what their side effects are. Because they're sold under the remit of supplements, people think there are no side effects, and they can, you know, the worst is probably that, you know, they're not going to work or have any effects, and you might be throwing your money away. But they generally think that, you know, well, what's the harm in taking them? They might be doing me good, or I feel great, or whatever. But actually, we really don't know what effect they're having, long-term effect, and you know, sort of, they're not, so I feel quite concerned about them, really. I think they should be used in very specific indications, specific strains where the research has been done, and I think we need a lot more information about them.
I think you're absolutely right, because we don't know that much, do we? And we don't know if there are any harmful effects that we don't really know about either, because I've certainly heard lots of people take probiotics and have quite significant adverse bloating or quite significant effects in their gut when they've taken certain probiotics. And I guess it's just not having that research and also not having as much regulation. And that also kind of, you know, it brings us back to, you know, eat whole food, eat fiber, eat, you know, all the things that we talked about right at the beginning, eat things that, you know, in the first place will be beneficial for your microbiome rather than trying to supplement it at the end afterwards. And I also feel quite concerned sometimes about the supplement industry, full stop, because I do feel that there are a lot of supplements out there that are being promoted to patients. And certainly I see lots of patients in my clinics that I say, well, what medications are you on? They give me a list of medications, the usual cardiac tablets, and then another list of supplements. And I mean, what do you feel about this? Do you feel that, you know, there should be some supplements that we should take? And, you know, how regulated is the supplement industry?
So the supplement industry is a very different industry to, you know, to medicines. And so there's a lot less regulation. And I think that as you find the same, I have clients that come to me with a long list of supplements. And one of the first things I normally do is I say, well, actually you don't need any, you know, most of these, because if you're having a healthy diet, you're getting, you know, magnesium, you're getting selenium, you're getting all these other things. And the same with, I think, with like things like pregnancy vitamins. You just need vitamin D and folate. You don't need any of the others if you're having a balanced diet. So really, I think the main ones you need are vitamin D in the UK, between sort of autumn and winter months, and then folate if you're pregnant, B12 if you're vegan, and I think that's about it, really.
Yeah. And what about omega-3 supplementation, because that comes up a lot in my, especially when it comes to cardiac consultations.
So I think omega-3 is a bit tricky because their evidence is quite mixed, but I think essentially if you like oily fish and you can eat it once, you know, twice a week, then you probably don't really need to supplement. And then, except if you've got like arthritis, it's been shown to be good. So both rheumatoid and osteoarthritis. You shouldn't have omega-3 if you're pregnant because of the increased risk of vitamin A, which is teratogenic, so it increases the toxicity to unborn child. And then I think if you're vegan, it's quite hard to get enough omega-3 just through nuts and seeds. And also it's sort of slower to convert into to DHA from ALA. So I think omega-3 is a bit more nuanced. I can't give you kind of sort of the same generalization. But if you if you can eat oily fish twice a week, then I wouldn't bother with an omega-3.
And we always keep circling back, don't we, to eating, you know, a healthy diet. That's it, isn't it? I think that's the underlying key principles are the same, regardless of what topic we discuss.
And I think, you know, sort of part of that is there's been a sort of evidence to suggest a whole food effect of omega-3. It's not just the omega-3 in fish. There are other factors at play as well, which we don't know about. So it's more than just the omega-3. And there's probably the same with other supplements as well, really. And I think if you can have a balanced diet full of, you know, fresh, wholesome food, that's really the best thing for you.
That's exactly right. We don't eat things in isolation. We eat food. Yeah. And it's very easy, isn't it, for us to demonize a certain macronutrient or nutrient, and when what we actually eat are things that have complex reactions in our mouths, in our guts, in our bodies, and it's our diet in entirety, isn't it, that we need to look at rather than the amount of this or the amount of that.
And I think that's really important as well when you think about your diet and think about restrictions, that some of these diets come with quite a lot of restrictions. So if you cut a whole food group out, it's actually really quite hard. It makes life a lot harder on a daily basis, cutting a food group out. And so, you know, I think everyone probably knows about low carb diets now and Atkins and all of these other things. And the studies sort of have shown that there might be a benefit to having a lower carbohydrate if you replace it with plant-based fat and protein. So that it possibly is associated with increased, so decreased mortality and morbidity. The reverse, if you replace it with saturated fat, so like the Atkins diet, actually increases your risk of mortality and morbidity. But it is still a restrictive way of eating. So I think all of this is about having a diet that doesn't give you lots of restrictions, that is about having adding more in, more choice, more variety, more healthy foods, and that is sustainable and that you can live for life and improve your long-term health by having that varied, you know, full diet of interesting, tasty food that is healthy at the same time.
And restriction just leads to yo-yo effect, in my experience, doesn't it? You feel that when you're trying not to think of the pink elephant, all you think about is the pink elephant. And when I'm trying to eat healthy or eat clean or not eat the thing that I'm, you know, demonizing at that point in time, then that's all I focus on. And I think it works for some people, doesn't it? But not for everyone.
It's not just you. I think an awful lot of people find it really hard. You know, as soon as you think of the pink elephant, absolutely all you can think about is the pink elephant. But I think for some people, having a really structured diet is helpful for them. But certainly for lots of people, you know, it can be quite boring, restrictive and challenging and increase your risk of, you know, disordered eating, which isn't really, you know, what you want. So, and I think lots of people don't really understand why the things like the low, you know, keto diet even came about in the first place. It's because it was devised for children with intractable epilepsy who were treatment resistant. And so it was a really short term measure for 6 months. There were defined endpoints, you know, assessment, and it wasn't meant to be a long term thing. So I think, you know, people, there's, you know, benefit probably to, we could all probably do with reducing our carbohydrates a bit and having more plant based fat and protein instead, but cutting it out completely is, and long term, it is really challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a little bit of a selfish question, because I love bread, my whole family, my husband loves bread, my son loves bread. How can you choose a healthy bread? You wrote a lovely post on it recently, and I thought that was a really nice kind of balanced way of putting it across.
Thank you. So I don't think that bread should be demonized. I think it's just about choosing one with lots of good, you know, healthy nutrients. So seeds and nuts and whole grains, you know, having a bread that's full of those is what you're looking for, really. And try to sort of steer clear from the refined carbohydrates, you know, your white sliced bread, but go for ones with all of those, you know, whole grains of spelt, with rye, with buckwheat, all of those things together. And it's so easy now to either make it yourself in a bread machine, or, you know, by hand if you really want to, or you can buy them. That, you know, I think that bread shouldn't be demonized and has a place in our diet, but It's about choosing one that's whole grains and it's going to have all that fiber and those, you know, omega-3 from the seeds and, you know, all of the other nutrients that they contain.
Yeah. And how do you go about creating a healthy meal plan? I know this is a very general question and quite broad and specific for different people, but do you have an overall plan when you're approaching, you know, planning meals?
So I've actually devised some different meal plans for different different groups of people, because as you go through your lives, women especially, we have these different phases where we actually need different micronutrients. And I think a lot of the time people just aren't aware that that's the case. So when you're breastfeeding, you need more calcium and iodine. And when you're pregnant, for example, you shouldn't be having omega-3. So they are like sort of little nutrient checklist so that you like give you a framework of what you should be taking, or not taking, what you should be eating within your diet and what sort of rough quantities. So for example, nobody knows what 1250 milligrams of calcium looks like, but if you know that a portion of something, you know, is a portion of broccoli or a portion of sardines or, you know, tinned salmon or whatever gives you, you know, half of your calcium requirement, then you can just tick that off knowing, oh, I've got my half my calcium for today. And I don't want anyone to be weighing food at all, but I just want, you know, sort of rough portion sizes to think, oh, I'm getting all of my nutrients. My diet is balanced. And I know that every day I need to have these things that, you know, are important to ensure that I've, you know, really remembered to have. And so, and they change. So I've got them for fertility, for pregnancy, for postpartum, so breastfeeding mums, for people with polycystic ovary syndrome, menopause, vegan, and then just a general adult one. And it helps you to sort of have that framework, really. They're free. You can download them from my website. And then I think for me, it's just about I'm on the sort of adult planner. I'm not vegan, I'm not pregnant or breastfeeding or any of those things at the moment. It's about having lots of variety, lots of, you know, filling my plate with the fruit and vegetables, a half of it, the fruit and vegetables, a quarter of my protein, a quarter of the whole grains, and thinking about that for each meal. And I think that's sort of how I do it, really.
That is incredibly helpful, and you know, we'll definitely share links to all of those in our show notes so people can access them. And Harriet, where can people find you?
I'm at www.healthyeatingdoctor.com, and I'm on the same for my Instagram, which is healthyeatingdrthedoctor.
Oh, I do encourage everyone to follow you on Instagram, because I've been really impressed by your posts, and I think I get a lot of information from them. In fact, I've shared them to friends and family as well, so they're very, I can vouch for them and the information that you give out. It's been really wonderful talking to you on this episode. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your immense knowledge.
Oh no, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We're really grateful to Harriet for sharing all that incredible information. If someone you know could find this episode helpful, then please do share. You can check out all the other episodes on our website, freshheartproject.com. We would be really grateful if you could comment, subscribe, and give this a 5-star rating. This helps us get the Fresh Heart message to more people. The content of this episode is not a substitute for medical advice from your healthcare professional. Remember, be kind to yourself, and small, sustainable steps create great change.
This podcast is produced by Lion Mountain Entertainment, a subsidiary of Morgan Archway Limited.